Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So we're going to talk about war today, and I'm going to do it in a manner of sort of walking us a little bit through our tradition. I think it's always good to pay attention to traditional voices in the church and see the depth of the tradition that we draw on and the beauty associated with that tradition. We've really, as a community, thought about almost every question in a manner that is illuminating and probative, and you'll see some of that in what we do. I also have strong views about how to understand the just war account, and I'm going to avoid the term theory and explain why in a minute, that diverge from probably maybe some of the things you may think about it, or if you've not thought about it before, certainly diverge from a lot of the professional opinion in theology and moral philosophy. But I'll give my argument for it, and I think my argument it prevails. This is the typical understanding of the just war theory, and it is understood as a kind of theory. Typically, people use it to make the case that this or that war is unjust, that you know somehow it is departed from the moral analysis that you see up there associated with these criteria, which I'll explain very briefly in just a second. I don't think this is the best way to understand the just war account, and while these different criteria are all important, I also don't think that the two categories of criteria are as differentiable as people often think of them being. So you're probably, many of you are probably familiar with these criteria. The categories are the jus ad bellum, or the right to wage war, and then the jus in bello, the how to wage war once you appear to have justified the war. And they are often understood almost sequentially or chronologically, sequentially in the way I just described. Can we go to war once we've entered into war? How ought we fight that war? The can we go to war questions being determined by things like right authority, who's making the judgment? In other words, right intention. What is the end for which we are doing what we're doing? Sometimes people understand right intention almost merely subjectively in terms of like what do I think about this? But instead, it's actually action guiding. Like, why are we undertaking this action? What is the end of that action? Just cause. What is the precipitating reason that we find ourselves now going to war? And today, both in international humanitarian law, in other words, like international law regarding to the exercise of war, and also often in a lot of Catholic teaching, you'll see just cause reduced to defense against ongoing aggression. That's the only possible just cause in the modern era, and there's an account that people will provide for why that is the case. And then the jus in bello stuff, discrimination or distinction. Distinction is the term, again, used in international law for discriminating between those sorts of people who you can target in your war waging, combatants typically, right? And those whom you cannot target in your war waging, being non-combatants, civilians, if you want to call them that. But in the literature, it's typically combatants and non-combatants. And then proportionality. I also like to make the point that what you see here is to some extent just action analysis, period, right? It's not simply, you know, the sort of analysis that one might undertake for justifying or thinking about why you've chosen to engage in war. It's also sort of the way we think about any kind of activity we're doing. As individuals, do I have the authority to make a judgment about this or that case? Do I have, you know, what is the end for which I'm doing it, right? You know, the right intention, what is the cause, and is my action proportional to, you know, whatever I'm trying to pursue? And am I, you know, making sure that I'm acting on the right people, discrimination and distinction? So another way to think about just war reasoning is just its moral reasoning. It's not a departure from the way we think about morality in general. And this is the, you know, the more important point. It's not exception making. And the view I advance of Catholic just war account is that it is actually an exercise in peacemaking. And this is the one that gets you into, you know, arguments with people. Most people think of the use of force that we associate with war waging must be a failure of peace. And I think, in fact, the account of our tradition argues, no, sometimes the use of force in the pursuit of certain ends can be peacemaking. It is itself a kind of instrument of peacemaking and not therefore an exception to the Beatitudes to love an enemy, and so on. This is an expression of a certain kind of love or charity given certain circumstances, and the analysis that we just showed helps us understand those circumstances where the use of force might in fact be peace pursuing rather than a departure from peace. And so it's not then a checklist of principles. If you approach it as a checklist, right, where you just go down the list and you say about any conflict, okay, was there a, you know, right authority? Well, yes, there was. The UN said this was a, you know, an appropriate use of force, or sovereign nations determined it was a appropriate use of force, or kings and emperors, you know, and so on, made that judgment. Well, what was the intention? Okay, the intention, who knows? We don't really ask that question very much, you know, because everybody claims, you know, they've got a good intention, right? So we won't worry about that. Just cause, we all argue about cause. Right, I'm right now in the Ukraine. Right, that whole conversation is animated by cause, with, you know, Russia claiming they have a legitimate cause for their use of force, and the Ukrainians counterclaiming, no, we have a cause, and so then it's just we both have causes, we both see things the way we see them. Who could possibly sift through that? So we just go to the questions of jus in bello. Right, we just go to that. The second category, and start to think, well, are we killing and targeting innocent people? Are we targeting civilians? And if so, then the war is immoral. Or is the use of force disproportionate to whatever aims we're trying to pursue? Well, if it is, therefore the war must be immoral. And to be frank, right, in almost every conflict, you're going to see some violations of discrimination. Second World War, right, rather famously, right, there is targeted city bombing, right, counter-city warfare waged by both sides. And if that means, you know, if that's how you approach this as a kind of checklist, you just say, well, all, you know, all wars are immoral, which is precisely what many people conclude. All uses of force are immoral because we're constantly violating those principles. Instead, right, this is the counterclaim, the just war account provides a description for the right use of political authority and governance for the common good, right? It is for the sake of a discrete common good that authority is authority authorizes the use of force under certain circumstances and does its best to keep that use of force in the pursuit of political goals. By political goals, I mean something normative there. The good goals associated with politics, like those things that conduce to the common good. It can't just be any political goals. For instance, the acquisition of more territory, right? Which could be justifiable in some sense, right? But it may not actually conduce to the common good, right? Plenty of peoples have argued in history, we need more room for us as opposed to somebody else, let's go take it. And that could be an illegitimate political end that would not justify force or other things either. It wouldn't not merely justify force. It wouldn't justify the use of sanctions or the use of a kind of coercive trading policy or whatever, you know, you might employ in order to try to extract some illegitimate political end. So political ends there is a kind of normative category. So the account, again, derives from a political perspective. It derives from the politics of a kind of Aristotelian conception of politics, common good-oriented or good-oriented, that is served by political leadership, those who are in authority, those who are legitimately in authority. And like I said, it's a discrete community. It's of a particular community. So the government of the United States has responsibility for the United States of America, right? It does not have responsibility for the common goods of other nation states. We can talk about the relationships of those common goods to each other, you know, in Q&A and so on. It's not to say there isn't some necessary relationship between those things, but it is to define the common good in such a manner that it is served by discrete political communities. You I hope, can already intuit in a way that how like provocative that claim is. It means particular governments are limited in the sorts of things that they can do, whether, again, it's using force, you know, the kind of force associated with warfare, or other political instruments in pursuit of goods that are not theirs. And peace, of course, is a principle of the common good. When we talk about the common good, one of the key features of understanding what that is that it is a peaceful, ordered situation. It means a kind of political stability, and there are all sorts of things that political authorities do for the good of the stability of their communities, including policing, right? So the domestic policing, the policing that is done within a state, serves the common good by keeping it relatively stable. We could see, for instance, during the pandemic, how valuable stability is, because when you stop policing, right, it becomes very difficult for people to assume the sorts of things that they typically assume when the order is stable. And you could argue, and philosophers have argued, that the lack of stability in a political community also contributes to the lack of stability in people themselves, right? It's harder to develop as a well-functioning human being when your political community is kind of a mess. And we could look all over the world and see different instances of kind of, you know, failed states where that proves pretty true. So I want to show you just a couple of different arguments or perspectives from within the Christian tradition that animate different ways of approaching the question of the use of force, right? This is a famous pacifistic approach from the people who, actually, you probably have some here in Ohio, right? The sort of, you know, Mennonite and Amish communities. They are the descendants of the men who got together and wrote in 1527 the Schleitheim Confession. With 1527, if you remember your history, that's, you know, roughly in the middle of the Reformation, right? Or the Reformations, sometimes scholars will talk about it, because there were different actors involved in upsetting the politico-religious order. And among those who were active were these guys who are sometimes called the left wing of the Reformation, or radical reformers. They're the ones who rejected what is called the magisterial Reformation, which is the one that we think of. When we think of the Reformation, we think of people like Luther and John Calvin, maybe Zwingli, if you know a little bit more about it. These guys were the ones who are like, look, you guys haven't gone far enough. Okay, you know, the Reformation is good, but you're just like Rome. You're like little Romes, because you refuse to really, this is the big issue, reject the sword and rebaptized, you know, and right, rebaptism, they're called Anabaptists, the rebaptizers. These other baptisms of infants, they're illegitimate, You have to be of age. You have to consent yourself. And they get together and they write a kind of a manifesto. What they believe, Article 6 of the manifesto, is this one. And the reason I point it out is, I'll discuss in a minute, because it's the fascinating view of the sword here, which is scriptural, and how they understand it. And they animate modern Christian pacifism. Right? This is the key point. They animate modern Christian pacifism, and their understanding of the use of the sword is connected to why they detach themselves from the political thing in general, which confirms to me negatively that the just war account is about a politics primarily. First and foremost, it's about a politics, a stance towards politics. So here they go. They argue, the sword is ordained of God outside the perfection of Christ. And the first important thing there to take away is, yes, the sword is ordained of God. They don't deny the use of the sword. In fact, like Scripture says, you know, the sword isn't ordained of God. It actually, God lets human beings use the sword. It punishes and puts to death the wicked, guards and protects the good. It serves a purpose, right? It is here for a purpose. Human nature is fallen, as we all know. People do bad things to each other, and the sword guards and protects the good. In the law, the sword was ordained for the punishment of the wicked and for their death, and the same sword now is ordained to be used by the worldly magistrates. Here comes where they depart from the magisterial Protestant Reformation and, of course, also from Catholicism. In the perfection of Christ, however, only the ban is used for a warning, right? So you can excommunicate from your community those who have wronged the community, but you can't use the sword. And for the excommunication of the one who has sinned without putting the flesh to death, simply the warning and the command to sin no more. We will not use the sword. The sword serves God's purpose. It is here for a good reason. But we Christians, those of us who are right followers of Christ, will not take up the sword. We will not serve it. We will not get involved in politics. That's worldly stuff. We instead are a holy religious community, not W-H-O-L-L-Y, we are a holy H-O-L-Y religious community. And the way we discipline each other is this way, right? It is the scriptural way. We will not use the sword that God has in his mercy, really, ordained for the rest of the world. Okay, so that's one perspective, and it actually becomes a very influential perspective in the 1960s and 70s in the broader Christian churches. It influences a kind of pacifistic approach to even the Catholic just war account or other accounts that are justifying the use by Christians of the sword. Alternatively, in my judgment, you have Augustine's account. You have a different sort of account. You may have had somebody present already this year on this a little bit. It's something we could talk about, again in Q&A a little bit more. But Augustine, rather famously in the City of God's, in the City of God, discusses how the real division in the world is between those who love God and those who love themselves. And that division of loves forms two distinct communities. There's the communities of the, you know, those who are Christians, followers of Christ, and those are the ones who love God even to the contempt of self. And contempt means, you know, hatred, right? And then there are those who love themselves to the hatred or contempt of God. That is the key, we'll say, primal distinction of human beings for Augustine. So how is this going to sort of play out in his politics, right? So he's going to say something that is similar to what the Schleitheim Confession says. This is all from the City of God. I don't know if anybody has read his City of God. It's really worth diving into at some point. It's massive, and it's not an easy read, but it's the sort of thing you can actually jump into in different areas and reflect on and eventually draw a lot out of. But here we go. So the heavenly city, right? So this is the community that lives in time, right? And for Augustine, the secular is really the time. It's a time period. It is this time period before the end of time when the church is sojourning, as he says, in the world, right, in time. The heavenly city calls citizens out of all nations. So this is, of course, the evangelical call, right? The heavenly city, those people who love God, will come from all of the nations and gathers together a society of pilgrims of all languages, not caring about the diversities in manners, laws, and institutions whereby earthly peace is secured and maintained. Right? This is really important. Doesn't really care about how earthly peace is maintained. Those who are in the city of God, recognizing that however various these are, they all tend to one and the same end of earthly peace. Okay, they're all serving this earthly peace. All these different ways of doing it nonetheless serve earthly peace. It therefore is so far from rescinding and abolishing these diversities, it even preserves and adopts them so long only as no hindrance to the worship of the one supreme God is thus introduced. So it just doesn't really care about the diverse ways different political communities pursue earthly peace. Because those citizens understand that's not the real item. Earthly peace is not the real item. We are all marked out for a different sort of peace. But that peace, that earthly peace, he will argue, is a kind of analogous approximation of the real item. Okay, right? It does relate to the real thing. And it also, like the Schleitheim Confession acknowledges, serves a good. It's not necessarily bad. We're not abolishing them because they're not the real thing. It preserves and adopts them. Right? We live in these different places among these people, and we adopt their ways of pursuing earthly peace so long as it does not require us to do those sorts of things that will impede our worship of God. And he is parsing Jeremiah in these cases when he's thinking about that, among other things, right, in our scriptural tradition. Augustine is a great scriptural theologian, and he's constantly measuring his reflection against scripture, or just drawing on scripture and his reflections to try to figure out what is being asked of us. And this is one of the more important texts for this perspective. Seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you. Pray for it to the Lord, for upon its peace your peace depends. Okay, so there's a connection between the peace of the world into which you've been exiled, like the Jews into Babylon. You have been placed in a hostile land. That peace that they enjoy, you should pray for it to the Lord. Your own peace depends upon their peace. You are to become inhabitants of that place while you are here and have children and learn its laws and learn its language, right, and serve it. And in a sense, you will be its best citizens. In fact, like the charter document for the university where I work, Catholic University of America, Pope Leo XIII, when he founded the university in 1891, he says, the reason we're doing this is so this university can help the Republic produce her best citizens. Those who understand, right, the nature of the earthly city is not the real item, but nonetheless, right, one upon which our own peace ultimately depends, will be the better citizens than those who think it's the fake thing is the real thing. They will love it inappropriately. So this is a long one. I apologize. But I can't stop quoting Augustine. Again, this is the City of God, book 9. I think it's book 19. Which is one of the more famous books. I love book 5 as well. But this is where he works out this Jeremiad approach to how Christians ought to live in the world. And you'll see him saying that miserable is the people who are alienated from God, Yet even this people has a piece of its own, which is not to be lightly esteemed. Though indeed it shall not in the end enjoy it, because it makes no good use of it before the end. And this is Augustine working on this language of enjoying it, right? Is a language that he works on in an earlier text of his. This is a later text, The City of God, especially the later books. It takes him about 12 years to write The City of God. In 397, shortly after he's made bishop of Hippo, he writes something called On Christian Doctrine. And in the first book of that, he works on this distinction between the use we make of things and the enjoyment we have of things. And the things that we can enjoy are really only the divine things. Everything else we kind of make a use of. And that's a complicated and long argument. Sometimes it bothers people because it seems like he's saying even the loves that we have for each other as human beings seem like a kind of use rather than the things we can enjoy. And this is kind of what he's saying. The reason he says that in part is because those things can be lost against our will. It's a famous phrase that he uses in On Christian Doctrine and elsewhere, is that you can't, that things that you can lose against your will can't bear your full loving. In the way that only that thing which you cannot lose against your will can. And that, of course, is God, God alone. Okay, so going on with this, it is our interest that it enjoy this peace meanwhile in this life. For as long as the two cities are commingled, we also enjoy the peace of Babylon, right? As long as these two cities, there are two cities, they're in time together, right? They're both in time together. You could think of the one city as the church, right? And the other as the world. And that's its own little controversial argument about in Augustinian theology. But it helps to think of it as the church, right? The church is here. It's on earth. It's in the world. So long as it's in time, it also can enjoy the peace of Babylon. For far from Babylon, the people of God is so free that it meanwhile sojourns in its company. And therefore, the apostle admonishes the church to pray for kings and those in authority, right? So we have a stake in the peace of the world that we are part of. And in peace thereof shall ye have peace, the temporal peace which the good and the wicked together enjoy. It's not alienating the holy community from the world. It's recognizing that it has to serve that peace. And he will also add to this in different books, like I said, that it can serve it better because it understands all of this better. So we understand, for instance, that the misery that we all experience has a purpose. The suffering that we experience as human beings in the world has a purpose. Sometimes that purpose is to test our faith. This is a point he makes, you know, a few times. You see this in scripture as well, right? Job's faith being tested. So sometimes, you know, it's kind of like an opportunity for you to measure how faithful a person am I, that I'm, despite being what I think is a good person, I'm getting rained on. Shouldn't God be shining his sun upon me, right? The kind of question that we often ask ourselves, and Augustine asks, well, no, because that's, you don't deserve the sun shining on you. You are a sinner. And if you knew yourself well enough, you'd understand that you're a sinner, and God's sun shining on you is not merited by your activity, right? It's not merited by the kind of person that you are. So as a believer, you know that. Oh, okay, you know, today it's sunshine. What a gift, right? Tomorrow it's rain. Well, that's, you know, I guess I do deserve that, and I can understand while I'm suffering. I can try to explain to my neighbors, you know, who don't understand it, why the misery that we experience happens to be the case. You're probably thinking, like, wasn't this supposed to be about war? It is. It is because it's about our stance towards politics. So this is my favorite passage in all of The City of God. I won't read it. You can read it while I'm talking. But it's this famous passage about a judge. And he's asking whether the judge will take his seat as a judge, even though he knows that justice is not perfect in the world. And this is a really important point that pertains to things like capital punishment, pertains to any sort of punishment. We can't have perfect justice in the world. If you have a system of justice, there will be imperfection in it. And you have to account for its imperfection when you make a decision to become a lawyer, to become a police officer, perhaps to live in the world the way we all do as citizens, and differently than, you know, the Amish, perhaps, or the Mennonites. And he answers, and here he uses the much more colorful examples of torture, right? You know, look, sometimes a judge is going to put an innocent man to the torture in order to get some information from him, and may even know the man is innocent while he does this. And he says, will that judge take, at the end, if such darkness shrouds social life, right? Such ignorance, imperfection shrouds social life, will a wise judge take his seat on the bench or not? Beyond question, he will. For human society, which he thinks it a wickedness to abandon, constrains him and compels him to this duty. He thinks it's a wickedness to abandon society. He's got an obligation out of love to serve society, and he will do his duty, even though the situation is imperfect. And in his age, as one theologian put it, you know, in writing about this, don't get distracted by the torture stuff. It's not simply a situation of torture. It's the way we incarcerate people, the way we do pursue justice in even the most, you know, advanced cultures that pat themselves on their back for being the most advanced cultures about justice. They are imperfect, and they will be imperfect. Perfection will elude us. We're fallen. So we will engage. We will take our seat. Right, we will take our seat and do these sorts of things. We will enter the military. Right, I think there are some people here who are, you know, at ROTC. Four of my children, three of my children have done ROTC or are doing it. We will engage and we will serve. That's like the stance toward politics. So our tradition has asked these kinds of questions over and over. Can we lawfully fight in and wage war? I just give you an example. Instead of like doing this typical Aquinas thing, even though it's the Thomistic Institute, I'm giving you Francisco de Vitoria, and notice the date, right? 1539. So this is virtually the same time as the Schleitheim Confession is written. Vitoria, some of you may know about a little bit about Vitoria, a Spaniard, a kind of Thomistic thinker. He's working on Thomas, one of the most prominent scholars of Thomas Aquinas in the 16th century. And you see, he's glossing Thomas himself, who's glossing Romans 13:4. Can a Christian lawfully fight in and wage war? The presupposition here already is Christians are engaged in the political service to the common good of the places they find themselves. Can they kill? Right? That's the question he's asking himself. Can they kill? And he goes to Thomas to say, it is lawful to draw the sword. There's that sword again, right? The sword that is in Scripture, and use weapons against evildoers and seditious subjects within the commonwealth. Because it is lawful to do this within the commonwealth, right? That means like policing. Because it's okay to do this as a kind of policing activity, so must it be lawful to use the sword and take up arms against foreign enemies as well, right? Many people, right, don't have as much problem with policing. We might argue about policing reforms and things like that. Can't we do it better and so on? But I've just kind of conceded already. We might be able to do it better, but it's never going to be perfect. Can we take up arms against another community, right? Here you have discrete common goods. The policing associated with the common good makes a lot of sense. Okay, we get it. We can do this. But what do we do when it seems like now it's a common good versus common good situation? That's what war is, almost by definition. Certainly, according to international humanitarian law, that's what war is. When states are engaging each other. And his response is, Yes, and he will work this out. Vittorio will work out this question with some depth. And he's saying, yeah, just as the government judges its internal evildoers, it can also judge the external evildoers in these particular situations. It can also make a judgment that they are in the wrong. You ought to be like thinking about some questions at this point. What about this discrete common good stuff, right? Well, it's not, right? All of this is governed by the natural law, ultimately, which supersedes, right? Guides the pursuit of the common good within any particular community. Right, it's outside of it and guiding it. That natural law, right, applies to all of those communities. And the way that Vittoria and his tradition at that point would see that kind of that the activity of the natural law guiding it was through something called the jus gentium, which is we don't really have as a kind of live category much anymore. It's jus, I-U-S, you know, the term that gives us justice, right, and gentium of nations, right, the law of nations would actually sort of guide all of this moral activity and tell people, give them some indication when the internal malefactors or when the evildoers were doing things, excuse me, the external ones were doing things that were wrong, and give you principles of judgment. One of the things, for instance, that rather famously the jus gentium governed was, and identified as a problem, was cannibalism, right? This is something that is clearly contrary to the law of nations, even though sometimes you would see these communities, exceptional communities engaging in cannibalism. But the Christian world would make the claim, look, this is clearly contrary to jus gentium, and then argue about like how connected that was to the natural law. So the tradition, I'm just like kind of marching us a little bit through different moments in the tradition. This is the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The tradition was making the judgment that you could, in fact, distinguish guilt and innocence. Okay? Guilt and innocence becomes the category that is important for determining when force can be brought against somebody. You see this in our tradition, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is still current, and people are writing about it, saying that the killing of somebody who is judged guilty, right, can be permissible under certain circumstances. So we can make judgments about guilt and innocence, according to which we can bring a kind of punishment upon those who are guilty. That was Vittoria's claim, that the king or the prince in a particular community could make a judgment internal to his community, this person threatening the good of our community, or he could also make the judgment in extreme circumstances, those people over there are doing something wrong according to the jus gentium, which means in a sense according to the natural law. Therefore, they can be met with the use of the sword. So that's the license to use force against certain people, but it's also the means by which you protect the other class. The innocent can never intentionally be killed, right? And that's what you're getting here. The deliberate murder of an innocent person is gravely contrary to the dignity of the human being, to the golden rule, to the holiness of the Creator. The law forbidding it is universally valid. You can never intentionally kill an innocent person. That is not the case with somebody who is guilty. You can, under certain circumstances, take the life of someone who is guilty, and they fill that out here. This was 2261. You go to 2263, and they're telling you, the killing that occurs in legitimate defense of persons and societies is not an exception to the prohibition against the murder of the innocent. Okay, we're not carving out exceptions. right? It's not a the prohibition is against taking the life of the innocent intentionally. It's not against the killing that occurs in legitimate defense of persons, right? It's a critical element of our teaching. And it, you know, you can see it pertains to war, and arguably it even pertains to punishment. And this is Benedict XVI, much more recently in Deus Caritas Est, making another kind of conclusion associated with this. The just ordering of society and the state is a central responsibility of politics. As Augustine once said, a state which does not govern according to justice would just be a bunch of thieves. It is the job of those in authority to maintain the just ordering of the good, the common good, right? The people that they are responsible for. It is the job, according to our tradition, of Christians to participate in that pursuit of the just ordering of society. We are not like the Anabaptists, the radical reformers, who recognize the good of that just ordering, but say that is outside of our care. We make this claim because we understand it to be an implication of our love of neighbor, right? Of our responsibility for serving those who live among us, even if they're outside of the city of God, even if they're outside of the church, we still have a responsibility to participate in this pursuit of a just ordering. So, you know, ultimately it is permissible for Catholics to serve in the military, not to do things that are contrary to what their church teaches them, not to do things, right, that inhibit their worship of God, but to serve other human beings, even by the use of force. And this is just some concluding ideas that stem from this, right? So Christians share in, make use of, and have obligations towards the peace of their city. All action is ordered towards peace. Our own peace, the peace of the community that we're a part of, that's the right intention idea. The morality that binds us in our, you know, quote-unquote private lives binds us always. This is not, you know, we've now entered into the political sphere and we can do whatever is necessary associated with politics. No, instead, this is how we're to live our lives in every, you know, private or public aspect. The distinction between guilt and innocence matters. This is really important because today it matters less and less for a lot of people. A lot of people don't really care about the distinction, or they claim not to care in different contexts about the distinction between guilt and innocence. Our church, in my judgment, continues to care about this quite a bit. Killing is distinguishable from murder. Again, that's something that not everybody will agree with. And the permissible killing in war is guided by these presuppositions. Thank you. I will entertain questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.